Hello and welcome to the Sheffield Digital Podcast. I'm Ian Broom and I will be joined in the conversations you're about to hear by directors Chris Diamond and Mel Kanarek, as always. This particular show is, as you might expect, something of a special. We're going to be talking about the coronavirus outbreak and the impact on Sheffield's digital businesses, digital sector, and we're going to be getting some expert thoughts and advice from two different teams, from two different companies. First, we're going to hear from Caris Thompson, Catherine Wilson, and Matt Ainsworth. They are all from Keebles, a legal firm and solicitors. They're going to be talking primarily about the government's measures that they've put in place for both business owners, employees, of course, and also the more recent measures around self-employed people too. We'll also then be hearing from the team at Shorts Accountants. So that's Martin Dean, Dave Robinson, and Tom Whitworth. They will also be talking about all of those things too, but coming at it from perhaps a slightly different angle. I think you'll find both conversations really interesting. As I speak now, they are already recorded, and I know that I found them useful listening to what the experts had to say. Of course, it's worth pointing out that this was recorded on the 27th of March. That is this very day I speak now. So things are changing so quickly. And if you're listening to this at some point in the future, of course, this information may at that point be out of date. So just check before you take anything said in the episode as gospel. And I think that's it. Apart from to say that we also recorded two other interviews at the same time. So we spoke to Mark Gannon from Sheffield City Council to hear from him and how the council are responding to the crisis, the kind of measures that they've put in place, and also a little bit about how it affects the digital sector too. And we also spoke to Neil Armstrong from TribePad, who make some fantastic and very popular recruitment software. They're a Sheffield firm, and they have seen some very interesting stats and data as a result of the crisis so far. And that interview is well worth listening to too. We've decided to separate the four interviews. So this particular episode of the show is going to be Keebles and Shorts. So this is all about the things you need to know as a business owner, as an employee at the moment. And then we're going to put those other two episodes out as episode 55, I think it will be, together too. So those are the two interviews. So look out for those as well. That's it. Enough gabbling from me. Let's hear from the experts. So thanks so much for joining us, Caris, Catherine and Matt. I guess in that order, can you tell us a bit more about your roles at Keebles?
Yep, sure. So I'm Caris Thompson. I'm a legal director at Keebles and head up the commercial contracts team. So we advise lots of different types of clients on their commercial contracts.
And I'm Catherine Wilson, and I'm an employment partner and head of the employment team at Keebles, and we predominantly advise employers, but also some employees, on employment-related issues.
Hello, everyone. I'm Matt Ainsworth. I head up the corporate team at Keebles, and we advise across the board on transactional work, but also funding work as well, which is probably the most relevant thing at the moment, I think.
That's great. Thank you very much. And thank you for joining us at such a mad time. What we've got is a variety of questions that have come in through our social media in response to a survey that we've put out and that kind of thing. And I think we'll just try and take them one at a time, and whichever of you is best placed to answer them, if you could kick in, that would be fantastic. So the first question is for people who are employed. If they get put on furlough, will that have any impact on their employment rights going forward? What does it actually mean for them when they get put on furlough?
I think the key thing to say is they can't be put on furlough, that it has to be designated by the employer, but it has to be done with their consent. And we can probably talk in a minute about what happens if you don't consent. But let's assume for these purposes you do consent to being put on furlough. The whole purpose is that effectively your employment continues and is unaffected. Quite what it means in terms of do you accrue holiday, what about holiday or pension payments, we're not sure as yet still. But the theory being that it should have no real impact on their employment rights. So if, for example, you already had 2 years service, you can still bring employment claims at the end of it. You would as well, if there was eventually a redundancy situation, still be entitled to those statutory rights. And it will count towards your continuity. So let's say you've worked for 20 months and you're on furlough for another 3 to 4 months, then at that point you would still acquire that employment right.
That's great. And we've heard that if you're on furlough, you can't do any other work. So if, for example, your employer put you on furlough and you saw that a local supermarket was desperate for delivery drivers, you couldn't then go and work for the supermarket as a delivery driver. Is that correct?
That is correct. In fact, in the government guidance that they issued last night, they did make an exception for people who are volunteering and training. But in terms of working for another employer, the theory being you can't do that whilst you're still being paid by employer A. They may, of course, relax that rule, I suspect, if they become very, very short. But the other key thing to realise is that when you're furloughed, the expectation is that you will return to work and you can be required to return to work at very, very short notice. So it would probably be inconsistent if you were carrying out another role for somebody else.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. But if you wanted to go and do some volunteer work in the meantime, unpaid, that would be OK.
I think that would be unpaid. And the key thing is to avoid any repercussions, obviously just check with your HR or your line manager and explain what you were doing and what that involved. And I'm sure for most businesses, that would be absolutely fine.
Right. Thank you. And then kind of looking at this from the employer's point of view, if an employer needs to put staff on furlough or makes the decision to do that, do they have to do it for everybody or can they just choose, you know, to put half on furlough and keep the other half working? How does that, what's the process for doing that?
Well, effectively, they don't need to put all of the staff on furlough. So there is an element of choice and need because it's only the people who are going to be furloughed whereby there is no work for those particular individuals. So there may well be work for others. Often for many clients, though, they are looking at sort of furloughing a proportion of the staff. So there's an element of choice. So one of the options is to look for volunteers, but the other one is also to do some type of selection to make sure that you retain the most appropriate staff, given the work that's available at the relevant time.
And if you were doing that, If your employer was kind of making a selection, could an employee challenge that? Could they say either, no, I really don't want to be put on furlough because I think I'm really important, or even though you're saying I'm important, I would prefer to be put on furlough?
I mean, certainly an employee could challenge it because obviously it's a question ultimately of consent. I mean, I think the other key thing that the government was at pains to say was when they introduced the scheme that it would always be subject to employment law. So there has to be some type of consultation exercise. And that would involve things like the criteria and why A or B was selected or, you know, some sort of dialogue with the individuals to explain their selection or non-selection, as it were. I mean, ultimately, if an individual objects to furlough, then depending upon what the contract says, you would probably be looking at a termination type situation. I think the other key thing to say is that just because you're not furloughed at the beginning doesn't mean that as the situation changes or develops, you won't be then furloughed at a later point. Because a number of clients are now operating at half capacity, that may go to zero capacity.
Yeah, okay. That's great. Thank you very much for that. Chris, are you happy for me to keep asking the questions or did you want to jump in at all?
No, you're doing a fantastic job. If I have a question, I'll hop in, but carry on.
Awesome. Thank you very much. Okay, so this one is more of a contracty question. So for someone who either runs a business or is a freelance contractor and they were partway through delivering a contract and it has a timetable to it, so it has kind of, you know, such and such will be delivered at such and such a date, and the company or the individual now thinks there's no way they're going to be able to deliver to that timetable, does that put them in breach of the contract? And where do they stand legally in terms of going back to their client and saying, I can't meet the timetable in this contract anymore?
Okay, so the first thing I would advise somebody in that situation to do is to review the contract and read carefully exactly what it says. So in terms of the obligation to deliver to that timetable, is that an absolute obligation or is it an obligation to use their reasonable endeavours to do that? And are there any specific remedies that are written into the contract for the other party if they can't do that, if they can't meet that timetable? Mm-hmm. If they're only obliged to use reasonable endeavours to meet that obligation, then that means that they need to balance that obligation against their own commercial interests. And obviously in the circumstances, they might be doing everything that's reasonable to meet that timetable, but not there might be something stopping them doing that. So that's one possible avenue for them to consider. There's also a lot of media attention around force majeure clauses. So that can protect somebody if they're unable to perform their contractual obligations because of something that's happened that's outside of their control. That isn't actually a concept in English law. That must be written into a contract for that to be able to apply. So that's something else to check, whether that is written in their specific contract. If it is, then they also need to think about and look carefully at how that provision is written. It depends how it's written as to whether it would cover this situation that we're in. It might be that certain events are listed as included in the provision as these X, Y, and Z will be regarded as a force majeure event, and a pandemic might be included in that or it might not. If it's more general wording and just says anything that is outside of our control, then that's probably going to be more helpful because I think the pandemic is going to be regarded as something beyond the party's reasonable control.
Yes, just a bit.
Yeah, exactly. And the government actions that are being taken as well. So it might not be the pandemic itself. It might be a government action that's preventing them from performing. Then if we think that it is within that force majeure provision, and it is covered by it, then you need to check whether there's any notification requirements. It might require you to notify the other party within a set period. There might be other requirements for you to take certain action to mitigate the effects of it. So there's lots of different possibilities depending on how that provision is written.
Sorry. Yeah, no, I just had a question. It's kind of the same question, but from a slightly different angle. I'm a freelancer, yeah. So the word that I've heard an awful lot is the word pause. So I've heard people saying to me, and I've heard other freelancers having a similar problems, let's call them, where clients have said, we need to pause this for now. So we're not going to cancel your contract, we're going to pause it. So far for me, it's been quite an informal thing, really. It's been a case of like, right, okay, that's fine. I've never kind of, and I don't know anyone else who's kind of kicked off or suggested otherwise. But actually, there must be, if you have a contract in place and it's something, for example, like we want you to do this particular job for 2 days a week for the next 10 weeks, and then you hear, we're going to pause that. Is there an obligation to fulfill those days or to complete that contract at a later date?
Well, again, it depends on what the other parts of the contract say. So from a force majeure point of view, the effect of the force majeure might be the obligation to pause, like you say, or it might be that either party's got the right to terminate. They might be quite specific effects from the rest of the contract and what the obligations are. It might be that the other party can't unilaterally impose that on you. They might require your consent. It might be that you want to give that consent in the circumstances. It might be that there's a formal process that you need to follow, a change control procedure, it's usually called. But the fundamental thing really, I guess, is if you do agree any changes to the way that the contract is going to work, to make sure that those changes are written down. Make sure that it's clear how long those changes will run for, what happens when that period ends, are you going to review it again or will it go straight back to the original obligations? So it's clarity is important on what any changes that you agree, and also to make sure that they're confirmed in writing.
Yeah, that's something I was going to kind of add into the conversation, is that, you know, a lot of us, the way that we work, we have very close relationships with our clients. You know, there's lots of trust two ways, and a lot of stuff, you know, the natural thing will be to talk to the client and to say, you know, okay, I don't think I can meet this timetable. What can we do? And to come to sort of an agreement through a nice, friendly conversation, but then not capture that in writing.
Yeah.
And yes, the advice would be to document.
Yes, the advice is to document it, even if it's just a follow-up email to say, thanks for that discussion, it was really helpful. Here's just a summary of what we've agreed. Emails count as writing. So it doesn't necessarily have to be in a formal document. It can be helpful, and particularly if the conversation is not so friendly and you think there might be problems further down the line, I think I would try and do it in a bit more of a formal way. But at the very least, yeah, confirm it in writing with an email after a verbal conversation.
Okay, that's great. Thank you. Right, so I've got a question now from the point of view of someone running a business where everyone is now working from home, which is basically the whole world. but as a lot of us know, we're also having to manage childcare because the schools are closed. And so it's hard for people to put in a full day's work when they've also got childcare requirements and homeschooling and figuring out how you're going to get the shopping in and all that kind of stuff. So if I'm a business and I've got people from working from home and they're not able to put in a full day's work, what as a business can I do? Can I reduce people's hours and reduce their pay, or what?
I think that's a really difficult question. I think that if we try and reduce their hours without their consent, then when this is all over, we're likely to face quite a lot of potential claims. I think obviously one could look at it on the basis that perhaps we don't need as many people, so that you can be laid off or furloughed while you're at home. Unless you've got the right, though, to introduce short-term working in the contract, which very, very few businesses actually have, then everything again has to be done with consent. Again, I think you would have to open a consultation with the individuals. As I say, you might look at furloughing certain staff. You might be encouraging people to take holidays. But again, I think, you know, it is all about demand and in terms of workload. So very difficult. I think the particular issues are with the childcare, that would tend to adversely impact female workers rather than male workers. So it's potentially unlawful discrimination. And the other key point to realise about discrimination on grounds of gender and or caring responsibilities is the fact that damages are unlimited, and it's what we call a day one right. So if I start working with you on a Monday and then by the Friday I'm home working, then I still have that protection. So I think great care and specific advice required. And I think probably a look at actually what work is required and whether or not the furloughing or indeed redundancies will be a better option.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, thank you. I'd like to turn to Matt briefly, just to find out. I imagine that there might be companies who are partway through a fundraise, or, you know, had started negotiations around a loan or something like that, and, you know, everything's gone mad and they can't progress it. Are you seeing that at all with clients, Matt? Is there any particular advice you'd want to give?
Yeah, we are. I mean, certainly in terms of fundraisings, I think there's a general acceptance that they will slow down. We hope to an extent kind of the tech sector is more immune to this than certainly some other sectors are. But I think for certainly early kind of early venture companies and startup companies, I think without a shadow of a doubt, those fundraisings, whilst hopefully they will still go ahead, I think there's an expectation that the length of time to get those fundraisings through is going to be, it's certainly going to take more time to do that. What we're also absolutely seeing is people who have been in discussions around loans or extension of loans with their banks or funders, where they've, you know, 2 or 3 weeks ago were given quite good assurances when they were starting to suffer a little bit in terms of the impact of the virus, that that those loans would be made available to them very quickly. Whereas now with the new scheme, the new business interruption scheme that's come in place, and the demand for that business interruption scheme, there's certainly delays in the process just of the amount and the capacity of people who are requiring this. I think absolutely key for clients is, and you know, and customers and the community, is to get front and face with the bank, be really active with the bank, and make sure that you are pushing as hard as you possibly can with the bank to make sure that you can get up the queue as quick as you possibly can. I think the other thing we're obviously seeing with these new, they're called CIBLs, these new business interruption loans, is it all sounded very good when the government first announced it. The detail is still starting to come through, but as may be expected, the implementation of it is a bit more testing.
Yeah, I think in a lot of cases, you know, we've heard good headlines from the government, but the devil will be in the detail of the implementation, won't it? And it's quite hard for businesses to stay up to date with what the latest situation is. So I think that's, we're certainly going to see that pan out over the next few weeks or so.
It is, and it's just a final thing. It's, I mean, you know, not casting aspersions on our banking industry, but some of the major banks, you know, they're not designed to be massively nimble on some of these things, and therefore, you know, actually, the time it's going to take for some of these loans to actually come through, you know, it's still going to put significant cash flow to the restrictions on some of our businesses, I think. So.
Actually, on that point, Matt, are there any other options available to, especially to startups? You know, should they be thinking about changing the legal format of their companies? Should they be switching to, you know, paying themselves salary in a different way in order to take advantage of other schemes? Are there any ways that they can pivot away from the need to secure these loans?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's obviously for very small businesses, those who are already effectively able to take advantage of the kind of small company business rates exemptions. There's going to be some grants coming through from the local authorities. Again, you know, timing when that comes through, we're not very clear around. But those are going to be £10,000 one-off grants made available to those who are already eligible for small business rates relief. I think in terms of, we have seen some already look to take advantage of things like furloughing, where they, you know, move towards employment status and see whether they can take advantage of that. I think the problem with furlough to an extent is it only impacts, I think, if you are employed, I think it's at the end of February, isn't it, Catherine? I think.
Yeah, so, you had to be on the payroll. When you had to have a payroll set up, you had to be employed as of the 28th of February. So changing, I think the argument being that I think the Chancellor described it as fraudulent actually last night in the broadcast, but the idea that people would redesignate themselves in March as something else, he felt was an abuse, and they wouldn't allow that to happen.
Yeah, yeah. But I guess some people are, you know, partially employed and partially self-employed, and that's how they take their remuneration effectively. And I've certainly seen people sort of looking at whether they can take advantage of their employment sort of aspects of how they remunerate themselves, or whether that can help with the furlough. But you know, it's difficult. You know, there's practical steps that people can take to try and ease short-term cash flow. Yeah, I think you're maybe speaking too short, but they will talk to you things around, you know, the VAT holiday, so the, you know, the income tax deferrals that are coming in over the next few months. that all helps the wee short-term cash flow, but you know, there is going to come a time where this is really biting businesses, I think.
I think I'm using this partly as an opportunity just to ask you questions of my own, which is what always happens, just a minor privilege. But I know lots of other people are in a similar situation. So I'm freelance. I'm a one person outfit, but it all goes through a company. So I have a limited yeah. company. So as far as I understand it, that disqualifies as a company director, despite being freelance. That means that me and lots of other people don't qualify for any support. Is that how you see it too?
I think in many intents and purposes that is probably correct. I think in terms of, you know, you still can take advantage. You know, things like, you know, the small business relief, you can probably take advantage of things like that. You will be able to take advantage of the things that are being across the board, so the VAT deferrals and income tax deferrals. You know, a business of your size, it's going to be almost impossible to take advantage of things like the Corona Business Interruption Loan Scheme, because fundamentally you're still going to have to show a base case to show that you are a fundable business, and therefore, you know, you're going to have some kind of critical mass to be able to do that, I think. So,
can I just want to double check on that, because there are a lot of us in a similar situation to Ian, myself included, where we operate as a limited company and we're the sole employee of that limited company. So in my case, I pay myself a minimal salary every month. And then at the end of a year, if there's stuff left over, I take that out as dividends. And I think probably a lot of other people work like that. So my understanding is that I would, if I wanted to, I could put myself on furlough effectively and claim 80% of the minimal salary that I pay myself. Am I correct in that understanding?
That is my understanding of how it works. But I think the problem is you can't unilaterally suddenly increase the level of that salary, because obviously they will look back at the PIOA records. And I think that's one of the things that we're seeing, that they're looking at what did you earn last year, or what did you earn in the previous tax year as an average. So I think you can furlough yourself, it seems to me, in principle, but you only get 80% of whatever you were paying yourself, and you can't suddenly increase what you were paying yourself.
That makes sense. And yeah.
And that may still be worth doing,
because it is a system that way.
Yeah. I mean, it's still some income.
Yeah.
Presumably you can carry on working when you're furloughed.
No. I mean, the theory is if you're furloughed, you can't carry out any work. How that would apply right. in your situation, though, I think is a bit uncertain. And that's obviously not what the scheme has been designed to. You'd be an outlier. So I don't think they really thought about how that would work in practice.
So I guess, well, you could carry on working. You just couldn't pay yourself.
Yeah.
Right. Well,
yeah. I don't know quite how. Yeah. I mean, I think it would be very difficult, because they are very strict on this not idea of not working. So I suppose you could say I wasn't working as an employee, but I was continuing to work in some other capacity. I think that's going to be difficult.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, okay. some of the self-employed rules, you know, the new schemes that came out yesterday, that, you know, they are different, and that did suggest that as self-employed to get the benefit, you could carry on working. Yeah. Again, I think the details, you know, we've got more details of the furlough scheme. I think the self-employed process, obviously, the first announcement was yesterday. You know, there's a lot more detail in practice about how that's going to work. And you know, the problem with that is it just covers such a myriad of different structures and systems, and how that's going to work in practice. You know, we need to see that, how that's coming through everything.
Mm. Okay. Well, that was an interesting little rabbit hole to go down.
A little uncommon one though in our industry.
No, not at all. An important one to address. So it's good to have a good discussion on that. I have a question regarding data security, which is if you're a business with employees working from home, so they're now using their domestic broadband connection to do their work, send emails and all that kind of thing, where does the liability sit for data security and the security of communication?
The short answer to that, Mel, is that the business is still responsible. So the fact that more people than might otherwise be the case are now working from home doesn't negate the obligations on the business to make sure mm-hmm. that the access to its systems are secure. So the ICO guidance that is given on this is that you do still need to consider the same level of security measures for home working that you would do anyway.
Yeah.
But having said that, it is quite pragmatic, the ICO, in the statements that it's putting out and the approach that it takes to compliance. And it has said publicly that it is accepting that these are unprecedented challenges and that it's not intending to take regulatory action to people who are doing what they can in a proportionate way.
Right. So as long as you can demonstrate that you did sensible things, then you should be okay. Yeah.
It's just it to a certain extent, it's an element of common sense. So if you've got all of your employees working from home now, do they all need to be able to access the same information that they would have been able to access if they were in the office? Is there more sensitive information that you can change the user privileges for to say that only certain people access that sensitive information? Mm. So it's a practical approach, I think, to considering the different way in which people are working now.
Yeah. And are you aware of a resource anywhere that people could go to? Like, is the ICO, have they got useful information available about this?
They've got a little bit of information. They've got some frequently asked questions, but I think the Cyber Essentials website is useful in terms of practical measures that people can put in place.
That's great. Great. Thank you for that. And one more, which is sort of a more broad sweeping question, which is, given that this situation is likely to go on for several months and we don't know when the end will be, what sort of steps should people be taking to protect their business legally?
Yeah, it's Matt. I'll pick this up. I mean, I think the absolute key focus is cash, isn't it, for most businesses? Mm. It's cash flow, protecting the cash, both, I think, short-term and medium-term. So we've already talked about some of the key kind of ways that people can start doing that now. The furlough process is clearly key for that, as well as some of the kind of tax deferrals that we've discussed around income tax and VAT. Mm. I guess some of the other things that people should be thinking around is insurance. So it's absolutely worth everyone reviewing or speaking to their brokers to review their insurance policies. I think some insurance policies do cover pandemic situations, but others don't. And probably for SMEs, they will be taking out, you know, in certain circumstances, more basic policies to cover these kind of issues because they're so unforeseen. So there may be some issues around whether that every aspect is covered, but, you know, certainly government lockdowns and impact of that could have favorable positions in terms of insurance. So, you know, if businesses are being impacted, then, you know, turn to insurance and see what cover you've got, and absolutely speak to your broker to see whether you've got any avenues down that route. I think, you know, the other thing that is being discussed and we're seeing a lot within our firm already is around lease obligations and rental position. So the government has not brought in anything to say mandatory across the board there needs to be rental holidays for businesses, but it has brought in a process where effectively companies cannot be evicted over the next 3 months until the end of June if they fail to pay their rent. So we are already seeing, which is the best route, already seeing within our team lots of discussions between landlords to defer rent, to come to agreements for rental holidays over the next 3 to 6 months to try and help them with cash flow to get through the period. So again, that should be something to be looked at. And by and large, I'm seeing landlords being relatively sympathetic to it, which they aren't always, but they are in all these circumstances. I guess the other thing, just the flag is, which is slightly negative and doomsday, but you know, hopefully, as I said, the tech sector will be slightly immune or slightly more immune to this than others. But there's inevitably going to be some business failures, I think. I mean, that's we're not expecting to see huge amounts of insolvency within the next 3 to 6 months because, frankly, you know, the people are just stuck from actually being able to do anything. And, you know, for insolvency markets to really be there, there needs to be funding from banks to enable that to kind of really kick into gear. But I think later in the year, we will start to see the implications from what we're seeing now. So for, you know, for directors, for business owners, they do need to be having an eye on that and needing to demonstrate that they have taken all proper steps in terms of managing their business as best they can, even in these difficult circumstances. So, you know, managing cash flows, looking at the cash flow, making sure that you are producing financial information as frequently as you can to demonstrate that even if your business does fail, that you've done everything you can to limit the impact on, you know, your suppliers and your creditors. Because, you know, if you don't, then there could be personal risk for people in those situations. So it's important not just take your eye off the kind of the normal business as best as you can, even in these circumstances. So.
Yeah, that's really good advice. Thank you very much, Matt. Before we wrap up, is there anything that you think we should have covered that we haven't done? Any particular bit of information or advice that you'd like to get out there to our community?
I think one thing that I was going to mention from the contract's point of view and going forward was that these circumstances are no longer going to be unforeseeable. So talking about the force majeure and things we were mentioned earlier, if you're entering into new contracts, then ensure that you do have protection in there if you can't meet timescales, if the measures that the government's taking continue for longer than we're expecting, or they introduce new measures that we don't yet know about. I think overall this is unlikely to be unforeseeable in the future.
Can I ask you what you're seeing as from your sort of unique point of view? What are people coming to you with at the moment at this very early stage in all of this?
It's for guidance on the what the government measures are, which is similar to the questions you've been asking us, how they can agree variations with their clients and their suppliers. But this is from the contract point of view, interpreting their current contracts. I've had some queries about data protection obligations as well, which you've also mentioned yourselves, so it's obviously on people's minds. Catherine and Matt, I don't know whether you want to say things that you've been hearing as well.
I mean, certainly on the employment side, most of the work this week has been about furloughing, redundancies, closures. I mean, that sounds like a real harbinger of doom, don't I? But effectively, very much on the staffing side, and how can we cut costs and how can we get the money as quickly as possible? So fairly depressing stuff, really.
Yeah, no,
I'd echo that. I mean, certainly the absolute focus at the moment for many businesses is on the employment side, because that's where, you know, frankly, you know, businesses have the opportunity for not free money, but it's effectively free money coming in from the government to help support them. So the absolute focus at the moment is people to make best use of the new schemes that are coming in. I think as we see going forward, we'll start to see some, you know, real hard looks at contractual arrangements and what can be done and what changes need to be made going forward, because, you know, to take into account of the clear delays that are going to be impacting commercial arrangements, I think. So.
And have you seen anything that any particular company, without naming names or anything like that, but anything that you've seen companies doing that you've thought that's a really good idea, they are dealing with this situation really well, maybe others could do something similar?
I think that, I mean, if I was being unkind, I think those clients who actually have a decent level of communication and treat their staff like adults and have what I would call adult to adult rather than parent to child type conversation are generally finding their staff are quite responsive, and therefore they're able to affect change very comparatively quickly for the good of all. For those clients of where I say a slightly more 1970s-esque approach, I think for them it is a bit of a struggle, both in terms of how they communicate with their staff and particularly things like the sort of trade union involvement as well. So I think it's a bit of a truism, but you can never over-communicate. And using all the tools that we have now, the virtual tools, things like Zoom, for example, I think they're all things that really work for people. I think the other key thing is that some clients who've got a more developed communication strategy are finding it a lot easier to keep in regular contact with their employees who may be home working or may be furloughed, because I think that is a serious concern, not just about the mental health issues, which I think are quite significant, but at the end of this, we're all going to have to come back together again. And I think having had sort of 3 months of no communication, I think that could be quite difficult. So having a good plan, I think, is really important.
Okay.
Great. Any good news?
It should be over soon. That's the good news. It should be over soon.
Great. Mel, Chris, have you got anything else that you want to ask?
I was maybe just wondering about how you guys see the tech sector versus some of the other sectors in the city. Whether, obviously, I'd imagine that the digital technology sector and digital media in general is less badly hit than some of the other economic sectors. Is that what you're seeing as well?
Yeah.
I think certainly from an employment point of view, sorry, Matt, I would say absolutely yes, because you're more geared up to use technology, you're much better at home working. I think it's those more traditional heavy duty manufacturing type businesses which find it particularly hard.
Absolutely true. I mean, obviously, hospitality and retail has just completely disappeared, and that's just non-stop. But to be honest, quite a lot of the manufacturing businesses, quite a few of them have actually just taken the decision to close.
Yeah.
Literally to fully close for 3 or 4 weeks. Because they just don't see, they've got to look at the cost savings of actually closing the operations down, which I guess is a short-term cash benefit. So I think, there's clearly going to be an impact on the tech sector. I don't think anyone's immune, but I think certainly they're probably in a better place than some of the other sectors where, not having people on the ground in the business working is just massively, massively difficult for them. So.
Yeah, it's going to change the landscape of the city and the region quite drastically, I think, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. Okay. That's a nice note. Thank you. Yeah, on that note. Thanks. Thank you, all three of you, for joining us. That is really, really useful to have you on. Hopefully that's going to help people who have been asking those questions and give people as much clarity as they can get at this point. So thank you, Caris. Thank you, Catherine. And thank you, Matt, for joining us. And good luck.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Yeah. Thanks for having us. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Right. Now we are joined by David Robinson, Martin Dean and Tom Whitworth, who are all at Shorts. And they're going to be answering some of our questions for you now too. But first, if you could just give us like a very brief overview of what you do, that'd be really helpful. Can we start with you, David, if that's all right?
Yeah, hi Ian. My name's David Robinson. I'm a tax director here at Shorts. Work in the business tax team, involved in clients day to day, advising owner managers and also large corporates on all aspects of tax. Work with my colleague Martin on M&A type transactions as well. In the particular current climate at the moment, I am in our COVID-19 response team, along with Martin and Tom that are on the call as well.
Excellent. And Martin?
Yeah, hi. So I work in the corporate finance department. Part of my day-to-day job is helping businesses raise finance. This will include things like creating business plans, investment proposals that often contain detailed forecasts. And as David says, I'm part of one of the members of the COVID team.
Great. And Tom?
Hi, Tom Whitworth, and I'm director of our RADIUS team at Shorts, where we specialise in helping businesses with research and development tax reliefs and innovation grants and such like.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you so much to all of you for joining us. Really appreciate it. I love the fact that Shorts has a COVID-19 response team, and I wonder if you've all got T-shirts or capes or something like that. But it's good to see that the firm very quickly pulled together a bunch of people. And I guess you've just come off all your day-to-day work, and this is entirely what you're concentrating on. Is that true?
Yeah, pretty much, Mel. So, you know, we've all got day jobs, but those are taking a back seat at the moment. Our teams are delivering the client work that we're having to leave. So there are five of us in total, plus one of the partners to lead it all up. And I think we just wanted to put a team together to kind of summarise all of the key measures that are coming out of government at the moment so that they're all in one place. So a couple of the things that we've been doing is updating our website daily for the latest announcements and the latest detail, but also have been sending out emails to our clients daily as well. I think it's just important at this time to try and be a voice of clarity to kind of guide our clients through it, but also, you know, try and give a bit of comfort that there are reliefs and measures available for businesses to carry on as best they can. Obviously, it's very, very strange times. We're all working at home. We're having this call, having this podcast via a call rather than in a room. But that's something that we wanted to do to try and help our clients through this process, really. What we've done.
The things are moving so fast, aren't they, and changing on a daily basis. What does it look like generally from you, from within your firm? What are you seeing happening with your clients in and around the city?
So it's a good question. Obviously, a lot of clients have got questions first and foremost. A lot of clients are, you know, concerned for the short term. There are some, you know, some needs for cash flow injections and to try and manage cash flow in general. And there's a load of measures that the government have announced to try and help that. And I think throughout some of the questions we'll go through today, hopefully some of those points will be explored in a bit more detail.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, when we were talking to the team from Keebles earlier today, that issue around keeping a very close eye on your cash flow and managing your cash flow was flagged up. Do you have any top tips for people on what they should definitely be doing?
So there are a few tips that we can probably go through today. I think my colleague Martin will have a few ideas as well. But me from a tax perspective, there are a few things that have been announced to help cash flow. So the Chancellor's announced that any VAT liabilities that are due to be paid between now and the end of June can be deferred without any penalties. So, you know, one of the things that we're suggesting to clients is, you know, take advantage of that. Don't pay your VAT. Keep the cash in your bank to use for cash flow. Businesses that want to take advantage of that should cancel their direct debit. That's a key message coming from government and HMRC. If you don't cancel that, they may still try and collect the money, which is obviously not good at the moment. Equally, on the tax side, corporation tax and pay-as-you-earn bills will be coming up for many businesses, particularly pay-as-you-earn. But although there is no automatic deferral of those liabilities, businesses can arrange with HMRC to have those liabilities deferred as well, and there's a helpline that businesses can call to try and set that up. So there's a couple of nice easy measures to help cash flow in businesses at this moment in time.
If I can just clarify something on that, with the cancelling the direct debit for your VAT, and if you do talk to HMRC about your corporation tax and PAYE, it's important for people to understand that at some point they are going to have to pay it. It's not being written off. It's just being deferred to help cash flow. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. So the liabilities are still due. They're just not going to be chased by the revenue, by HMRC. Yeah. So the VAT deferral that is automatic, the latest we know on that is that HMRC are going to expect the payments to be made at some point up until the end of next tax year, so around April 2021. Our experience on the corporation tax and pay as you earn is that HMRC are fairly relaxed in having some of those payments deferred for 1, 2, or 3 months, but they are expecting those payments to be made in the short term. Whether anything comes out from government in respect of the automatic deferral of corporation tax and pay as you earn, we're yet to see.
Excellent, thank you. Sorry, I cut across. Martin, you were going to add something there.
Yeah, so one of the things that the government announced pretty early on, really, before the job retention scheme and other schemes that have come out, is the introduction of £330 billion cash injection in by the way of loans. So I think to try and set the scene on these loans, to try and give a bit of detail for listeners to understand, the technical name of the scheme is the Coronavirus Business Interruption Loan Scheme. It's a bit of a mouthful, so I'll just refer to it as coronavirus loans for now.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the scheme has been set up by the British Business Bank, which is a government-owned institute. They've designed the schemes, and lenders have been encouraged to adopt the scheme as one of their lending packages. In theory, the scheme's attractive to lenders because what the government are saying is, on the face of it, they will guarantee the majority of the loan if things go wrong. So from a lender's point of view, there's an incentive to set the scheme up and lend businesses money, knowing that the government will bail them out if things go wrong. So that's a current scheme that's in place. Now, the idea being that it will help to inject some short-term cash into businesses. And that's another option.
Yeah. So earlier on in this podcast, we were talking about the loan scheme and had it referred to as a SIBIL, which I thought was a very charming name for something that is perhaps not quite so charming. A couple of things that I've seen just kicking around on social media and that kind of thing is one, that the loans are all very well, but you've got to put your house up as security. And another thing is that the loans are all very well, but the rates of interest are very high. Have you got any information or comment on those?
Yeah, so I think that's, from the information that we've got, that's wrong. There's a lot of advice on the British Business British Business Bank website that you can refer to. And one of the conditions there regarding security is the fact that your house won't be at risk.
Yeah.
So that is a misconception. Under this scheme, the banks won't take your house if the bank loan goes bad.
Okay.
So that is something that is on there, that is out there. That's not to say that the issue that we have at the minute is that particularly with the security elements, is it is at the discretion of the lenders. So what we're seeing different lenders, particularly the banks, the main banks are there, the main option for most businesses. There are different criteria and they are wanting different levels of security. And there's been a bit of backlash for that, really, because particularly in this market that we're in, the lending market overall is going to minimize and the appetite to lend money is going to reduce. So what that means is that most businesses, the only real option is to talk to their incumbent bank, the bank that they currently bank with. There doesn't seem to be an appetite, for example, if you bank with one one mainstream bank to apply for a loan in another to another bank, it's, there doesn't seem to be the appetite that you'll get a successful application from that. So, so, but in terms of answering the question, because that's quite key, a lot of people will be scared by that. That's not under this scheme. The government won't allow that to happen.
Yeah. Well, that's encouraging. And so I guess to find out whether you're eligible for one of these loans, essentially the thing to do is go and talk to your bank. Is that what you would say?
No, there are some eligible checklists for businesses. Like I say, the main source to go to and use is obviously come to our website. We've got lots of updates and FAQs that are on there for these sorts of questions. Also, the British Bank website that have set this scheme up, you'll see a lot of the eligibility checklists on there. So, for example, the key criteria for most businesses is that the loan, the application for the loan must be for business purposes. One of the conditions is you must be a UK-based SME. So you've got to be a UK-based business. Your turnover must be turnover from rental income and investment income mustn't be more than 50% of the overall turnover of companies. Now, most businesses should fall should be fined under that category. So there is checklists there. There are you do have to be eligible, but the advice is to go to the British Business Bank website. That sets out the principal nature of the scheme that's been set up, and you'll find a lot of information on there as well as our own website.
Yeah. Okay.
I think if I could just add to that, Mel, as well. I think so. Yeah, the message I think from Martin and his team is that, you know, businesses are better off talking to their own bank first. They're more likely to get something there than with other banks or financial institutions. So I just wanted to add that on there as well.
Yeah, that's correct. I'd echo that.
Yeah, that's really good advice. Thank you. We've heard quite a lot about the £10,000 grant for small businesses, but it applies only to those that pay business rates and, if I'm correct, currently get some kind of business rate relief. Have I got that right?
Hi, Mel. It's about right. So for the £10,000 grant being made available, it is for businesses who currently receive small business rates relief or rural business rates relief. And if they receive that generally, then they will get a £10,000 grant. There is a couple of other grants available as well, another £10,000 grant or a £25,000 grant, but that applies to businesses in the retail, hospitality and leisure sectors. And the list is quite extensive from the government about who fits into that sort of cafes and theatres, shops and so on. But yeah, coming back to your point about business rates, it is those particular grants are for businesses who already pay business rates as a matter of course.
Yeah. And Tom, do we know yet how people get those grants? Do they need to apply, or will it come automatically because they're already on a list of, you know, businesses that get rates relief?
So we've put a blog up today on our website that we can share, but having spoken to a few people and looked into it, it's the grants are going to be administered by local government authorities. So for example, we think Business Sheffield for Sheffield Council, Enterprise in Barnsley for Barnsley and so on. The advice from the government initially was that you don't have to do anything if you're a business. You will be contacted and the money will be sent to you. However, a lot of these bodies now have set up online portals where you can go as a business and kind of more proactively register your details to help with that process. What I think that is for businesses who may not have their bank account details with the council and so on, which kind of makes sense. But it's these are portals where you say who you are, what your property is, what grant you're applying for, and you fill in things like bank account details. So most of the local authorities have got links up there by the time this goes out, we think. So it's a bit of a mixture, I would say. If it was me, and what we're kind of suggesting to businesses is to, if you think you're going to be applicable, then maybe proactively go and register your details so that you are picked up quick.
Yeah. Okay. Good. That's good to know. Of course, there's quite a large sort of community of businesses that fall through a gap there where they work, you know, they're a new business or a small business and they're actually working in a co-working space rather than paying rates on their own office. And presumably they're just out of luck on this one, aren't they?
It does seem that way for these particular grants. And I think it's a good point that you make because they presumably may have to keep carrying on paying their rent for these spaces where that might not be open anymore. But like you said, don't pay business rates and therefore aren't going to get the business rates holiday, but also these particular grants.
Mm, yeah. Okay. We've heard a lot since yesterday evening about support for the self-employed. Can you very quickly talk us through that, just so that it's absolutely clear what the self-employed can expect and what they need to do, if anything?
Yeah, I'll probably take that one, Mel. So it's David here. It's very early days in terms of any details, so we are still trying to get our heads around stuff. But I think, you know, the government was under a bit of pressure, quite rightly so, to do something for the self-employed, having done something already for those that are employed last week. So the headlines for the self-employed guys is that there's a self-employment income support scheme that is being introduced. What that means is that effectively anyone that's self-employed and that gets more than 50% of their income from self-employment may be eligible for a grant. The grant is up to £2,500 per month based on the profitability of their self-employment in previous periods. Now, there's a couple of stings in the tail, unfortunately. So people have people have to have been in self-employment in the 18-19 tax year. So anybody who started self-employment from the 6th of April last year, unfortunately, will get no benefit at all through this scheme, which will come to a shock, comes a shock to a lot of people and will leave a lot of people obviously annoyed and feeling left out. In addition, anybody who is earning over £50,000 profit in either the 18-19 tax year or the three-year average from 16-17 onwards, again, they won't qualify either. So just to add a bit to that, so the way that we think this is going to work is that if somebody has got £50,000 or less profit in the 18-19 tax year, they can make a claim if their profits this year are less than they were last year. Likewise, if that doesn't throw up a grant, those individuals can then compare the current year to the 3 years from 16-17 onwards as an average. And if that gets a more favourable result, they can use that period to make a claim. So clearly a few little nuances and details to come out on that in due course. The latest that we know is that it's going to be at least June until any payments are being made to individuals. So obviously sat here in March, April time, there is at least 2 months before any payments are going to be made, which will put a lot of pressure on the self-employed, unfortunately. In terms of making a claim, so at the moment the Chancellor announced that because HMRC have got all the information to process these grants, the revenue should be able to do that automatically. However, our understanding is that there's going to be some kind of portal application form type thing for the self-employed to make a claim. So our key message at the moment is to try and be proactive. So if you are self-employed, I'll be speaking to your accountant, trying to understand how much profit you made in the last 3 years, making sure that your tax returns are all up to date, trying to understand what kind of grant you would be eligible for come June, but also making sure that you've got the relevant support to make the application at the relevant time. Can't stress that enough. Get in touch with your accountant, really, just to get that ball rolling.
Yeah.
The caveat on all that, sorry, Mel, is that there's a lot of detail yet to come out.
Yeah.
And I guess people just have to watch this space.
Yeah. And I mean, if you're self-employed and you have been for a number of years, you quite often have to sort of pay tax. It's almost like in advance in installments, don't you? So, did I see something about the July payment being deferred as well?
Yes, that's right, Mel. So if you've got a payment on account or income tax due 31st of July this year, where the tax arose from self-employment, that payment is automatically deferred with no interest, no penalties. You won't have to make that payment until next January.
Right.
So that's a welcome cash flow advantage for those self-employed. But of course, you know, if individuals aren't getting any income in, the grant funding isn't going to be until June. That there is going to be some difficulties there for people, I'm sure.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's try and change it up a little bit before we all get very depressed. Things like R&D tax credits. I mean, for technology companies, a lot of them are still going to be doing what they do, creating software products, doing research and development. Will those sorts of businesses still be able to apply for tax credits?
Yeah, absolutely. The R&D tax credit scheme is continuing through this, and as far as we can tell, isn't affected by any of the measures, you know, surrounding VAT and payments to HMRC and such like. What we're saying is that this is probably now or soon is a decent time to be looking at whether you can claim R&D tax relief, because it can be reduction or refunds for your corporation tax liability that you've already paid, or a tax credit cash back from HMRC for businesses developing software, so limited businesses developing software, spending money on wages, etc., to make advances in technology through software development. They should be applicable to make claims. So what we're saying is that HMRC are meant to be making the payments back to businesses quicker than they have been to help, but also it's, as things stand at the moment, businesses that have done development over the past year or 2 years, perhaps, it's work that they've already done and can probably benefit from if they've not already claimed or looked at claiming. So probably quite a good time to be looking at that now or soon.
Yeah, so we'd really encourage businesses to have a look at that. And we've got stuff on our website that you've provided from Radius that talks about what kind of work is eligible, because I think quite often people assume, because it's called research and development, R&D, that perhaps the work they're doing doesn't qualify, but actually there are quite a lot of ways to make work qualify, aren't there?
Yeah, it's quite a broad definition. It's not people in lab coats necessarily, as it were, and for software, some software development can be quite straightforward. Not that I would know how to do that, but some, when you're looking at some that's really quite advanced and some of the products and services that have been developed, then there's a lot that would become applicable. That as you say, Mel, maybe people don't think it applied to them or their business and what they've been doing, or maybe it perhaps touched on it a little bit in the past, but running business has got in the way of that. So that there's a lot of opportunity, and for businesses to develop to benefit from that and help with their cash flows. I think also for businesses that are used to making claims and are used to the process, doing it sooner rather than later might be helpful as well.
Yeah, excellent. Thanks for that, Tom. So assuming, some businesses are still going to be carrying on, and while they may see, drop off in customers or, contracts being delayed or stretched out, some of them are still going to need to raise funds. They're still going to be working to a plan. Have you got any advice of how to go about fundraising in this current situation?
I'll step in there, Mel. So as we touched on, David touched on really, the key thing to understand from the banks with these loans is they're going to want to see that you make taking all the necessary steps to try and absorb all the schemes that are currently out there. So if you're looking to apply for one of these loans under this scheme, they're going to want to see that it makes sense for most businesses. Most businesses will be doing it, is trying to get the grant income first. They'll want to see that you're doing that and actively seeking out that sort of funding that's available. Then it's a case of applying. Now, some practical and essential things that you need to understand really when applying for one of these loans is that you need to prepare some sort of forecast. So most businesses will need to forecast the next sort of 12 months. Now, for most businesses in this current situation, don't be scared of putting zero income and putting all the costs that are going through. The bank will want it, they need to be convinced that businesses need this loan because of the situation that's currently in play. So that's really key to understand that you need to be looking at all of the avenues of income before applying for one of these loans. You're going to have more success of getting one of these loan applications through if you are taking up all the options. That's really key. So things like, as well as preparing a forecast, you need to be looking backwards and thinking about presenting and gathering the information for the banks to consider. So get on your bank's website, download the application form for one of these loans, and look at the criteria that's required and start gathering that information. Now, some of it you may not be able to do, and that's where you need to sort of lean on your advisors, your accountants to help, because the key thing to understand is a lot of businesses are going to be applying for these loans. What's really key to understand is from the bank's perspective, they're going to be dealing with thousands and thousands of applications for these loans. So you need to be prepared and give yourself the best chance of getting the application through quickly, and so it gets past the credit process and you can get cash in the bank as soon as possible. So the key message is that banks need to see that you're prepared for this and you're thinking about everything, all measures, which most businesses will be doing, but it's key that the business owners understand that really, and that's going to help raise funds for them.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you so much, guys. I mean, we've covered an awful lot of ground here, and I'm sure that as things continue to develop, then there'll be even more questions. But you said that you were sending a daily bulletin, which I actually receive. Are you happy for me to make that available to the community?
Yeah, that's fine. So, that's going out to our clients, but also contacts we've got on our database. So, if you want to forward that on, that's fine. Yeah, more than happy.
That's great. Thank you very much for that. And just before we finish, is there anything that you think we should have covered that we haven't in our conversation?
So the only thing that I had on my list, Mel, was this job retention scheme.
Yeah.
So for any of your listeners that have got employees that they employ, obviously they'll have seen just over a week ago, Chancellor announced that the government will step in and pay 80% of employees' wages up to £2,500 per month under this furloughed workers scheme. The kind of principles of that have been covered, I think, in the press recently, and hopefully all the listeners are up to date on the general aspects. However, a lot more detail was announced on that by the Chancellor last night, so on Thursday, the 26th of March. We're still working through the detail, but the message to businesses is that if you are taking advantage of the furlough scheme, one, it's really important that you get agreement from the employees that they accept to be furloughed. But the other point is that it's not just as simple as paying them 80% of whatever they are on, or £2,500. There are some nuances around how long people have been employed, whether they're on sick pay, whether they're on maternity pay. There's loads of stuff that we can't cover now, but yeah. I think if anybody's thinking about using that furlough scheme, head over to the government website, or obviously we've got a lot of detail on our shorts website, and the key message is to be a bit proactive on that and speak to your accountant.
Okay, that's fantastic. Thank you very much, David. Gentlemen, thank you so much. Loads of really valuable information, and we'll keep in touch with you and share more information as you're able to make that available.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, thanks for having us on. It's been great. You know, some of it's good news. There's obviously a lot of uncertainty at the moment and people working from home, but I think, you know, we're going to get through this, and the measures introduced are really, really positive. So there's a lot to take from that, I think.
Okay, there you have it. That's the two interviews. I hope you found some of that useful. We all at Sheffield Digital hope that you're okay, and do feel free to get in touch with us and let us know what you're going through and however we can help, or anyone can help, really. And if you want to subscribe to the podcast, of course you can. We've got interviews with other people in the Sheffield digital sector lined up. And of course, we've got an archive of shows and interviews too. You can subscribe in Apple Podcasts or whichever app that you normally use. And you can find out more at sheffield.digital/podcast. And feel free to pass this on to someone else if you think that they'll find it useful too. And that's it. Until next time.